all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today James McClellan. Jim, or Doc, served in the Marine Corps, but we have him on today on Veterans Radio to talk about the Medal of Honor. He is a recipient of the Medal of Honor in July of 2017. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you. That was 2 years ago yesterday, by the way, that I received the medal. And 2 years ago today, I was being inducted into the Hall of Heroes at the Pentagon.
Well, it's been an amazing 2 years, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But before we get there, let's set up who you are. You know, just a simple boy from South Haven and Bangor, Michigan. Give us a little bit of your high school and college background.
Yeah, well, I'll just go briefly back all the way where we didn't have electricity in my house until I was 5, nor running water until I was 8. My dad got a shell of a house from his grandparents, and it was rural Bangor. And I went to a little one-room country school 1 mile down the road, walked there and back home uphill both ways every day. And my brothers and I packed our own lunch and that kind of thing. And then, of course, when I got into junior high, I went into the junior high and high school there at Bangor. I then became very involved in music and athletics. Had 4 leads and 4 musicals in high school and 11 varsity letters in football, basketball, baseball, and track. Also was very involved in student government and Key Club and those kinds of things. So I have been busy all of my life. Was a candidate for Annapolis. And was one of the top candidates in 10 states until we got to the physical part where they found out I was colorblind. And they do their signals in red, green, and white flags, and I'm red, green, colorblind. Held me over an extra day and gave me these charts. Can you see any letters or numbers in there? And, of course, all I saw was dots. So it wasn't until 2 days before I graduated from high school that I found out I was not going to be wavered on the color blindness and that I was rejected and eliminated from. So I worked that summer in a factory, literally in a factory, and thought, well, I'll just be another blue-collar McLuhan. My brother had started school, and he was my older brother's 2 years older than me, and he had started school. He was the first McLuhan to go to college. I became the second McLuhan, was lured to a college called Olivet College, south of Michigan State, and when we went in, I saw him practicing football. I don't remember what the registrar said in an hour's time, but when she got done and she said, is there any questions, I said, yes, can I still go out for football, even though they've already started practice, and she said yes, and the rest of the story is I earned 7 varsity letters from Olivet, and football wrestling, I started wrestling for the first time in my life, and baseball. And was very involved again in music, was in a barbershop quartet and all kinds of solos through high school and in college, of course, and still do a lot of that solo work now. So that set me up for probably the next question, whatever it is, about going into the Army.
Well, let's put a cap on the college career in that you graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts and a teaching certificate, and you were you accepted a teaching and coaching position at the South Haven Public Schools, and then the Army said, "Hey, Jimbo, we've got a plan for you."
Yeah, actually, in May, just prior to my graduation on June 4th, I had signed that contract with South Haven. I'd be coaching 2 sports and teaching actually elementary PE at that particular time. That was 1968. And I got a letter from my Uncle Sam, and he said that they would like me to take a physical. And I really just thought they were trying to see who in the area was, you know, physically fit and this and that and the other thing. But No, they said they wanted me to send me to a tropical zone before I started teaching. So,
one of the things that's always interesting on, particularly for our Vietnam veteran medics, which you became, is how you ended up being an Army medic. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yesterday I told you prior to us beginning on radio today that I was at the Boy Scouts Jamboree, the World Boy Scouts Jamboree, and a question was asked to me in my talk to some of the scouts and their leaders, and there was a medical unit there. Of course, they're like a city with themselves, and the medical unit was the Army medical unit. And some lad said, "Hey, you know, how was it that you didn't have any medical background here? Why did they choose you to be a medic?" And this is what happened, I'm sure. Studying to be a coach, of course, I had a minor there in physical education, and I took kinesiology, physiology, anatomy, first aid, advanced first aid, strapping and taping. So I'm sure they thought that was a pretty good background. Nothing can prepare you for what you're going to see as a medic in Vietnam. I can tell you that, because it was horrendous, some of the things that I saw, and have told only to one person, and that's my counselor, a Marine paraplegic in Grand Rapids.
And Jim, you were assigned to a combat medic unit with Company C, 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment, 196th Light Infantry Brigade of the American Division, and did your tour in Vietnam from March of 69 to March of 1970, and saw one hell of a battle in May of 13th to 15th of 1969. Why don't you give us the short version?
Okay, we heard on May the 12th in the evening, there was some talk going around that we may be sent into an area to block a hill. Well, the next day, the 13th, at about 7 in the morning, it didn't take us long, about 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and we were getting shot at as we came into the area, 13 helicopters and 89 men from Charlie Company. We had had some skirmishes prior to that, and we're down in numbers. And actually, two helicopters got shot down during that approach to just at the base of about 2 miles from or 3 miles from the base of the hill, Nguyen Hill, where the NVA and VC were entrenched. And we had some injuries because we couldn't even land. They didn't want to land the helicopters. When you're coming in a hot LZ, they tell you to jump out. We jumped out from about 10 feet in the air with our full packs and our weapons and everything. So I did have some injuries to take care of right away. One of the helicopters was shot down. Those crew got rescued right away, but another one, we had to have that platoon that was with them bring them in, and about halfway in, one of the guys collapsed out there, and that was my first rescue. I ran out about 100 yards, and slid in next to him. They're shooting at me. Of course, they're assaulting him. I'd say they're 75 yards away from him, meaning they, the NVA. And I asked him where he was shot or injured or wounded, and he said he wasn't wounded. He hurt his knee jumping out of the helicopter. And I looked at it, and it was about the size of a volleyball. I said, "Well, hang on to your weapon. You're going up on my shoulders." And I weaved on the way in, and of course could literally see the bullets skipping off the ground around us. But my men were firing at them and keeping them so they couldn't get a really good shot. And I got him in safely and got him out. That was my first rescue in the 48 hours that we were going to be there. That evening, they asked my platoon to go out and search the area. And I'm thinking, these people back at battalion must be nuts. Didn't they know we had two helicopters shot down? And one of them couldn't even get rescued because of kind of firepower that the enemy had. And I said that there must be a lot of them out there. But sure enough, we marched out towards that hill, got out there a mile and a half. I could only guess how close we were getting to the hill when we got ambushed. I looked up on the hill when the ambush started, and Nguyen Hill was about a mile away, I'm going to guess, in that area. and they looked like lava coming down off there. So at this particular time, I realized there were lots of them. Had a call for a medic, and I was at the in a trench line at this time, jumped up on a berm. There were two guys over in the bush. They had been on the front of that particular ambush, and the squad that was in front. Four guys got killed right away, and these two guys I headed towards. They were about 10 yards away from the edge of the trench line, and I heard a big explosion and felt a ping all over my body and didn't pay much attention because the adrenaline was flowing. I just had to get to these guys. They didn't have any weapons. They had left their weapons behind, and I drugged them across that berm and into that trench line. Noticed they weren't injured or wounded, so they were kind of scared and in the bush areas up on top of the berm. Turned and looked up on the berm again, and there was about 5 yards away an NVA. Two NVA were there, but one NVA was looking me right in the eyeballs. And he had an AK-47, and I'd given up my weapon prior to going up on the berm. So I said to the two guys that I drug across, follow me, and we started down the trench line. It was slowing me up, so I said it's going to be more dangerous out there, but I'm getting up so I can run faster. And again, bullets skipping off the ground. Of course, I didn't think at the time, but I just got wounded, and so concentrating on my two machine gunners who were in the trench line when I jumped on the berm had retreated, and they were about 75 to 100 yards back, and I could hear their M16s going by my head, so they were shooting at the enemy. Got close to them, and all of a sudden heard a voice saying, medic, and so I turned around and went back towards the enemy that was slowly coming at me, and in and out probably about five times in that process, and then nightfall came and they backed off. We got the wounded and a couple of dead on the helicopter. We did get a medevac helicopter in, and the company commander looked at me and said, Doc, get on. And that's when I realized, oh yeah, I did get hit out there. And I looked down and I had my blood all over my body. I'd hit from head to toe with shrapnel. And I looked at him and I said, I'm not going. And he said, why? And I said, you're going to need me, because I had seen how many were out there. And I could hear my father saying, Jim, you never do anything halfway. You always do it to the best of your ability and do it till the job's over. And I'd rather be dead in a rice paddy than in a hospital, safe and sound, and find out that one of my men got killed because I wasn't there to do my job. But I did think, when I refused to get on a helicopter, that I just spent my last day on this good earth.
And really, I think that's one of those questions I wanted to ask that you lead into, which is, you know, what's going on in your head, Jim McLuhan? You're being told, don't go back. Don't go back out. Stay back here. Get on the helicopter. Yeah. But you refused to evacuate, and you continued to go out into the kill zone multiple more times to extract your wounded comrades. Is it your dad's voice that you're hearing? Is it something else?
Well,
is it a combination?
I think it's not. You know, I often tell kids, you know, you can't. Don't forget your roots, and also make sure that you take all of the mentoring that you can get from your parents and your relatives and your teachers and your coaches. I think that, you know, the credit has to be given to those who raised me, and it does take a village to raise anyone. But yeah, and you know, the background that I had as an athlete, background I had as a Christian, and so on and so forth. But the big thing is that, yeah, I think the thing that does it is you get so close to those men that you don't want to leave them, for crying out loud. It's going to take all of you to get some of you out. And so, yeah, that was the big thing. And they backed off that night, by the way. The enemy made all kinds of noise out there, and they had women screaming and dogs barking. And we kept them at bay. The company commander called in artillery, and we did get some help from the Air Force and the Marines. And shooting in from about I'd say about 4 to 6 miles out on China Sea was the Navy, excuse me, with their big guns. So we did get some help, and that kept them at bay. But the next day it was real quiet, and I knew the second day, I knew that quiet was not good.
And this is because this is May 14th, isn't it, Jim?
This is May 14th. This is the second day, and I'm taking care of the minor wounded. Of course, I worked on anywhere from 40 to 50 in 2 days, and there was another medic with us at that particular time in the morning. And I'll get to that later on, but anyway, I'm thinking, you know what? They're just laying low and they're coming closer to us, and this could be it, you know. And sure enough, at about 4 o'clock that night, which was about the same time that they told my platoon to go out the night before, they said, we want you guys to move out towards the hill. And their reasoning was, then they won't know where you're at. And I'm thinking, they know where we're at. A matter of fact, they're out there waiting. And I couldn't believe it. The first platoon, I was in the second platoon that went out the first night. First platoon was asked to lead the way out, and they didn't get out very far before they were hit. And so that night I was very busy, very, very busy, and was hit twice more, once with AK-47 while I was sitting like a duck in the rice paddy because I couldn't move one of my wounded soldiers who had some of his organs. He had been hit in the stomach. So I had to get them back in and put pressure bandages on those and put water on those two. And then I drug him into another trench line that the French had left there and kind of was in trying to figure out, how am I going to carry this guy? I can't throw him up over my shoulder. So I decided that I would cradle him and run through the, this was one of the times I was glad I was short, because all I had to do is squat as low as I could and run as fast as I could at that particular pace, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a thought came over me that it had been since I was a small boy that I told my father that I loved him. In the 50s and 60s, we didn't do that. Men didn't tell men that they loved each other. And I knew my dad loved me, and I'm sure he knew I loved him, but it just wasn't a social thing. And so I had a conversation with the Lord, and I said, Lord, if you get me out of this hell on earth so that I can tell my father that I love him face to face again, I'll be the best dad, I'll be the best coach and best teacher that I can possibly be. And this incredible peace came over me. It wasn't in my ballpark anymore. And if I was to die in that battle, that was the Lord's will. And if not, then I had to keep my bargain. And ran to my father in the airport in March of 70 and threw my arms around him, told him I loved him. And he did the same, like we've been doing that for the 24 years that I had been alive at that time. And that was our greeting and our departure. Taught my children, my grandchildren, my athletes, and even the guys that I fought with. We tell each other we love you. We love each other. And the rest of that night, I had another couple major wounds, and then they backed off and they were chased off the hill. 101st came in and helped us out. Marines really came in. Of course, by that time, the Navy had blown the heck out of that hill. So, we were pulled out after 48 hours.
Well, and I want to give one more little fact, and we'll move on here. And veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Jim Doc McLuhan, who received the Medal of Honor from President Trump in May of 2017. But on the night of May 14th, 1968.
In July of 2017.
I'm sorry, July.
I received them. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But going backwards to the battle on May 14th of 1968, one of the problems in any kind of extended encounter is you run out of supplies, and naturally your platoons did, both food, ammunition, and medical supplies. You volunteered to hold a blinking light in an open area as a marker for a nighttime resupply drop. And this is while folks are, the NVG's shooting at you, but the importance of that mission couldn't be underestimated. Jim, as you're raising your hand or saying, I'll go do it, as the only medic that's left, what's going through your mind?
Well, nobody jumped up, and I knew how important it was. We needed more ammunition, so I just jumped up and went out there and crawled out there, so to speak, and was in a prone position. And there were firing an RPG over the top of me, but their big problem was they were too close. They were, unless they did a direct hit on me, and that would have been the end of the world for me. But they were also, they were shooting at that blinking light. And the biggest thing that I thought about was, while I was laying there, wait a minute. If they hit this light down here, that ammunition is going to be heavy. It's in crates, and I'm going to be dead anyway, but we needed it that much. And they never got it in. The pilot called back after he retreated. He couldn't get close enough to us and said he had 27 bullet holes in his helicopter. That's what we found out later on, that he had 27 holes in his, and nobody in his helicopter got hit. That's the amazing thing. So we were down. I know when the battle was over, I was down to a half of a magazine, which is about not anywhere from 9 to 10 bullets. We had passed it down the line if we got overran to save one bullet for yourself. We were not going to get captured. And that's pretty amazing when you think about that. That's almost, it's hard to even imagine that any group of individuals would be in that predicament, but that's where we were at the time. And we were rationing. And the head platoon, of course, what they call a CP, main platoon, they were sending their ammunition out to us because they were back there calling in, you know, help, and they didn't need their ammo. We had them as protected as we possibly could make it for them.
Now, we get to the next morning, May 15th, you actually get knocked mm-hmm. out by an RPG grenade shot into the area, I guess, and yet continue to, after that, come back and treat casualties. Tell us how this battle comes to a conclusion in the rest of your time in Vietnam.
How this battle comes to conclusion?
Yeah, on the 15th, the day of May 15th.
Well, the NVA moved off the hill, and so we were back to, you know, really well protected, too. We had got the 101st Airborne in there, and the Marines are flying over the top in the Air Force. And again, the Navy is at the position to shoot in if we needed. But it just got calm and they were gone. It was going like from night to day. It was just calm. And I actually had not had anything to eat and drink. And you can imagine the effort that I had put to carry people and to work on other people and to, you know, still fight. I was one of the fighting men too. Vietnam was the first time medics carried weapons. And so I had my M16 and was fighting also. And I kind of collapsed after we got everybody on the helicopter. And the next thing I woke up in an aid station, and then they took the IVs out, and I went back to my unit after they took the IVs out.
So,
back to my company.
So this battle is in May of 1969, a few months mm-hmm. months after you start in Vietnam. You stay in Vietnam mm-hmm. till March of 1970,
mm-hmm.
And then get out of the service and have an amazingly productive career as a teacher and a coach and a husband. Tell us a little bit about your post-service activity.
Well, first of all, let me remind you that I did have a conversation with my Lord, and I told him that if he kept his end of the bargain, I would do my best. And there I carried on the theme of my father, never do anything halfway. I was extremely grateful for having survived that year in Vietnam. So, you know, to be able to do what I wanted to do and loved, and to be around athletes and to be involved in education where I can prepare kids for later in life. And that was my goal, was to prepare kids for their own Vietnam. Their own Vietnam might be a good friend moving away, or the girl that they want to marry saying no, or their house burning down, or losing a job, or not getting a job, whatever that is, their parents passing away. I wanted to prepare them for their Vietnam like I had been prepared for mine. And so, first of all, I loved what I did. And second of all, I put as much effort into that. And I was very busy. I was busier than most people get. Coaching three sports, And one of those sports, also I coached in the summer, of course, I coached 35 American Legion teams in the summer. I ran the summer recreation program, the men's and women's softball programs. I played on a team. I've coached 22 little league teams and 13 junior wrestling programs. So part of that was, I realize now, and I realized it after I retired and things started flooding in, that I had become a workaholic, so I didn't think about those things that I saw in Vietnam. They started flooding in, and now I realize that I kept myself busy, so I didn't think about those things. And so I was fortunate enough to come right back to where I had hoped to be in this area. And I had my South Haven, Michigan doesn't even know the offers that I had had along the way, but I enjoyed where I was and the kids that I was raising. And of course, after a while, you're coaching kids of kids that you originally coached. And then in the end, I was coaching grandkids of kids that I originally coached in the beginning. So,
well, it was, as I say, it was an amazing career in coaching, and a testament to that is that you've been inducted into the Michigan High School Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame and the Michigan High School Coaches Hall of Fame and the Michigan High School Football Coaches Association Hall of Fame, you know, honors delivered by your peers to the work, really a body of work over decades. And let me turn that concept over.
In June.
Go ahead.
In June, sir, I was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma. That was another humbling experience for me, too.
And it's interesting you say, well, I kept myself extra busy, so I didn't have to think about some of the things I had to see and do in Vietnam. And I think a lot of people find that keeping active keeps some of those demons away. But also, it's great to be recognized by your peers. And I guess that's, I want to use this as the transition to talk a little bit about that portion of the Medal of Honor that only a recipient knows about. And Jim, we talked about this a little earlier. It's a whole process for the Medal of Honor to be awarded. Can you talk a little bit about that back end piece? We all see the press coverage on the day it happens, but there are years in front of that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, 4 months after the battle, my platoon lieutenant came to me and said, "Jim, Doc," he said to me, he says, "I put you in for the Distinguished Service Cross, and they told me you were nothing but a PFC, and they don't get that." Who told him that? I do not know, and I don't care. And I looked at him, I said, they told me to put you in for the Bronze Star, which he did, and it went right through with V for Valor. I looked at him and said, "Sir, I'm not here to get any medals, and I just want to get home and be a teacher, coach, and a dad." And then in 2009, he went back ever to Distinguished Service Cross. Took him 6 years and 4 months to get it from the Human Relations Committee into the Army Board of Decorations and Awards, which is where it has to be to really start. So it really took him 6 years and 4 months doing a stack of assignments, paperwork about 10 inches tall. And nine of my men had contacted him and written eyewitness letters, notarized eyewitness letters. And so it had finally gotten into the Army Board of Decorations and Awards. That's in 2015. Remember, he started in 2009. In 2016, exactly a year later, August of 2016, the lieutenant and I had heard nothing for a year. And so we did inquire at Debbie Stabenow's office, because she was now the person that was my representative. And they called back the next day on August 13th, 2016, to tell us that it was now at the Pentagon. I get a call October from Debbie Stabenow, and I had declined her call because I didn't recognize the phone number. And so she left a message, and the message went like this: "Hi, Jim, this is Debbie Stabenow. This is October of 2016. She said, "This Debbie Stabenow, Senator Debbie Stabenow, and you know, we've been trying to get you recognized for your heroism in Vietnam. And the good news is it came across the desk of our Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, and he looked at the material the lieutenant had handed in, and he read the 9 eyewitness letters, and you couldn't give me a medal high enough to replace those letters. They said I did my job. And he said the Distinguished Service Cross was not high enough, so the Secretary of Defense had recommended me for the Congressional Medal of Honor. We weren't still out of the woods, she said, because that has to be given within 5 years of the action, and it had been 47 years at that particular time. So Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters combined to write a bill that had to be passed in the House, and Representative Upton got it passed in the House, and then on December the 8th, it was passed in the Senate, 92-7. And Obama signed it on the 23rd of December, 2016. The Secretary of the Army has to sign it, too, and he signed it on the 27th, and it wasn't until 5 months later then that my wife and I received a call at home from President Trump, who had taken over, of course, in January, to tell us that he was going to award it, but we had to be quiet until they found the date. And they did find the date 2 weeks later. They called it, called me. It was Colonel Walters out of the Pentagon. And she said, Jim, in 5 minutes, it was 5 minutes to 11. She said, 5 minutes, the United States of America and the world will know that James C. McLuhan is going to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor on the 31st of July. So I thanked her and I hung up and called my wife and I said, watch the news. I'm about to tee off. And she said they tweeted it at first, and then all of the news stations picked it up. And two guys that I was golfing with that day, I'd coached with for 40 years, and they got to hear for the first time. They were surprised because I'd never talked about this, of course. And they got to hear for the first time that I was, they thought I was spoofing them at first, but they heard that on that day that I was going to receive the Medal of Honor, and they were both at the ceremony, by the way. My son was called. My son's a lieutenant detective with the Michigan State Police. His name is James Bradley McLuhan, and he spent 25 years with him up to this point. And though 2 years ago, he got a call in the evening of the day that I had received the medal, and it was one of his colleagues, and his colleague said, Jamie, I saw your father get the Medal of Honor from President Trump today. He said, when did you first hear this story? And Jamie said, today, the same time you did.
Well, as you said, you don't. This your action in Vietnam was not to receive any medal or recognition.
No.
It was to take care of the men.
Yeah. Well, when you, you know, when you're drafted, and I was a patriotic lad, and of course I didn't volunteer to go in, but I didn't run after they drafted me. Your first mission is to serve your country and, you know, make your family proud that you served as an American. But once you get there, sir, it's just about how many of us together as brothers and fighting brothers of in arms, fighting men, that we could get out of there alive ourselves. You know, we're concentrating on survival. But you know, I'm very proud to be a Vietnam veteran. We did win the war. That's another story that I can back up. Professor Pike, who's a student of Vietnam, a researcher of the Vietnam War, he died in 2006, and he said, we did not lose a major battle of any consequence, and it was a defeat for the NVA and the VC. In 1973, when the Americans moved out, the NVA had been defeated. Many, many, many more killed than we did, than we had killed. And of course, people will argue it, but it's the truth. The men of Vietnam, the fighting men of Vietnam can be proud that they kept communism out of all the countries from Singapore down to the Philippines, because they didn't want to mess anymore with the United States fighting men. And they did not attack those countries.
Amen. Yep. We're talking to Jim McLuhan, recipient of the Medal of Honor for his action in Vietnam. Jim, let me back up, though. I want you to give talk a little bit about the lieutenant that you served under, who initially put you in for the Distinguished Service Cross, and then ultimately, 40-some years later, said, this still doesn't sit right with me, and spent 6 years working on this.
Yeah, he said in his letter that he wrote, and I didn't know this, but he got the Silver Star he got the Silver Star, and Lieutenant Clark did not shoot one bullet in that whole, you know, he was with the CP and doing what it was he had to do. And he said, you know, those guys out front that were keeping us protected and keeping the enemy from overrunning us should have got the Silver Star. And he had pretty much put, he'd put the war behind him. And I'm extremely grateful to him for wanting to do this and then sticking in there that long and telling him, they made him do one particular thing, and that was the chain of command, a DD-638, where he has to get the endorsement of everybody up the chain, and he has to send that to everyone personally. So it was going back and forth, you know, back to him and then to the battalion, back to him, to the brigade, back to him. It took him 4 years to get that whole particular thing done. They made him do it 3 times. And, yeah, for him to stick in there and for my men to not forget what we had done together. And, you know, Hatton, one of the machine gunners, tried to tackle me twice the first day. He was afraid I'd get killed going back into the kill zone, and I wouldn't be around for him, you know, to be saved by myself. So they were very protective of me. And by the way, something that a lot of people may not know, Daniel Shea was the only other medic left in the second day, and he was killed going out about his 4th time. And I actually brought his body back in. And he received the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously. His mother received it in 1970 from Nixon. So 2 medics, this is unprecedented as far as I know. I've tried to find any other situation in which this occurred. 2 medics, same battle, same company, received the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's how brutal that battle was.
It certainly puts things in context, and it's again, I want to acknowledge the stick-to-itiveness of Lieutenant Clark. To make sure that this injustice, which happened right afterwards, got corrected, even though it took 47 years or so to get it corrected. If he didn't do that, we wouldn't be talking, right? That's how this works.
Yeah. Absolutely, we wouldn't be talking, and I would still be, after 48 years I had the Bronze Star, and it would be 50 years now that I'd have the Bronze Star and not the Medal of Honor. And to put other things into perspective, sir, the 2 most important moments during the 2 days that I was receiving recognition, the 2 favorite moments for me, was when one of my machine gunners finally got his Purple Heart 48 years later, and it was pinned on him in front of his 3 daughters by a 4-star general. They finally righted that. And then when my men were asked to stand, 10 of those, 10 of those men from my company were there in the ceremony, 5 of them I had saved in the battle. And they were asked to stand, and they finally got their recognition. One of those men's wife told a friend of mine who sat next to her, she was in tears, and he asked it what was wrong, and put his arm around her. She said, 48 years ago, my husband tried to tell some of his friends about this battle, and they told him he was full of shit. She said, today, they know he wasn't full of shit, that he really had experienced something that is unbelievable, and you wouldn't believe it if you told a common person that they wouldn't believe it. Horrendous.
Absolutely, and it also fixes some of the injustices that our Vietnam veterans had to go through of shame and of being involved in the war and how America treated its returning Vietnam vets. So you can feel her pain.
Yeah, her pain.
Exactly,
yeah.
Jim.
Her pain.
I want to bring one more aspect to this, and we've run longer than we said we were going to, but you knew I was going to do that anyway. And I want to talk about what I referred to as the responsibility of being a Medal of Honor recipient. Can you, as you reflect back now over a couple of years, can you talk to us about how you view and have internalized that responsibility?
Yeah, well, there's only 71 alive in the United States of America. That really puts a lot of responsibility on the 71, but there's only about 30 of us that really do go out and go to all these different places to speak and to be recognized sometimes and to kind of be highlighted, so to speak. And it is a very heavy response. I was home 4 days in March, and on those 4 days, I did my laundry and repacked to go to the next event. I just got back yesterday. I was in West Virginia yesterday to get home for this interview today, but I did get 18 into this morning, 18 holes golfing. But you see, I will go to three or four more major events. Next week I'll be in Kentucky for a golf outing put together by Woody Williams, who uses the money to put together Gold Star family monuments. And then I'll be going to the to Alaska, and from Alaska down to California, and then finally back home to be able to go over to Chicago to the 196th biannual convention, where I'm a keynote speaker. Then back home down to Indianapolis, Indiana, where I'll be the keynote speaker at the National American Legion convention. And then I still have one more thing. I don't know exactly what the... Oh, we're going to get together, as many of us as we can, because this is the 50th reunion of the battle, of the 1969 battle. We're going to try to get together here in South Haven and just spend some time together and have a wonderful, wonderful time as brothers.
But it's more than just an active schedule. As a Medal of Honor recipient, you really become the embodiment of military valor that not only other veterans but civilians and kids. Yeah. Talk to us about how you're received there.
Yeah, that is tough for us, because we just considered we did our duty. And my wife has pointed out, you know, every once in a while, Jim, you need to recognize that you really are a hero, or what you did was heroic. And that there's young people out there and other people that need to know that there are those kinds of people in this world. And we have what's called the Congressional Medal of Honor Character Development Program that goes at the elementary, middle school, and high school level. And so we train, teachers can be trained free. They get a scholarship to be trained. Then the material is all free. So what we really want to do, yeah, your responsibility is to make these children understand, and everybody else that don't quite understand yet, that freedom isn't free. That and I often use those that didn't make it home as the example. They really gave up two lives. They gave up the life that they were living when they were killed in action, and then they gave up the life they never got to live. They never got to meet their soulmate, marry her, and see the birth of a child, and maybe coach that child and be at that child's graduation, and maybe walk that baby girl that was a baby at one time and now she's a grown woman, walk her down the aisle and have that father's daughter dance at the ceremony afterwards, and every holiday, every anniversary, and every family gathering, they gave that up. So they gave up two lives. I want people to realize that those 18, 19, and 20-year-old men, the flip side of my job is not saving, but watching men say their last words and watching them take their last breath. They gave up two lives so that we can have the one that we're living now. That's the responsibility that we feel, and we know who the real heroes are. Those men are the real heroes. And we will always recognize them as the men that gave up something we didn't have to give up, and we survived.
Well, I think these stories and talking with Medal of Honor recipients helps us realize, as you mentioned, sort of heroic actions by those who lost their life on the battlefield, as well as those of you who have been awarded this honor. And in a world that is so flaky and Twitter and Facebook and social media and movies, I think it's easy for kids in particular maybe to lose sight of what real values are, what real heroism is, as compared to what it looks like on a graphic game screen on your computer. So I think the work that you and the 30 active Medal of Honor recipients are doing is really important, and we're glad that you had some time to share it with Veterans Radio today, Jim.
Yeah, well, and of course, all veterans who have been out there fighting for freedom, you know, the war does not leave them when they come home. So once we've had that experience, it becomes a part of the rest of our lives. And we need to reach out there to those 22 that are dying each day of suicide because they're having problems internally and psychologically with what they were kind of forced into at times to fight for freedom.
Well, we want to thank Jim McLuhan, Army veteran, Medal of Honor recipient, for taking some time out of his busy schedule to talk to Veterans Radio today about his experiences. We're glad you got 18 holes in today, Jim, and that you played pretty well. And thanks for doing this.
Well, I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank you and all of those radio stations out there, but thank you personally for what you do, Jim, because this is another avenue of helping those that can't go to the events that we're at, or they don't get to hear from those who have been right out there. You're taking these across the air to people that may not have the opportunity to be educated by us.
Well, we're glad to.
Thank you so much.
We're glad to bring this to this wider audience, Jim. And thank you again for being on Veterans Radio today.
God bless you, Jim.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.